Tonight, as we continue our studies in American history, we shall consider what Alexis de Tocqueville had to say in his first book. That is, we shall begin a consideration of some aspects of chapters 3 to 5. Now, Alexis de Tocqueville came to America primarily to study the prison system in the United States. His purpose in so doing was, as a person prominent in France and in the government thereof, to analyze the ideas in prison reform and the handling of criminals that prevailed in this country. He did that. But even more, while he was here, he paid a great deal of attention to what was going on in this country, intensely interested and concerned. And as a result, he went back and wrote up his account of what the American people were like in a book published first in this country about 1841 in two volumes, Democracy in America. Now, Democracy in America is a very remarkable work by a man who is determined to do his best to understand America. Tocqueville was by background an aristocrat. He belonged to the French nobility. He was everything that was alien to America. Yet he was a remarkably friendly and thoughtful observer. The reason why de Tocqueville was concerned with understanding America favorably was this. He was convinced that the whole direction of world history was moving in the direction of democracy. This is why, although he recognized that the United States regarded itself as a republic, he called his study Democracy in America. He felt that it was important to understand democracy because he was quite sure that in not too many years the European nations would be very sorely infected, moved by, and ultimately governed by the democratic temperament. Now remember when de Tocqueville wrote, there had been the French Revolution not too many years before, but it had failed. Napoleon had taken over, and Napoleon had been overthrown, and the monarchy reestablished in France. All of Europe was governed by monarchy. It seemed very clear that nothing was more remote than the fact that democracy might one day become the governing sentiment of men and nations. So we must recognize that de Tocqueville was a very shrewd observer. He very clearly saw the direction of history and the nature of the 20th century. He felt that the idea of democracy would lead to equality, and that the battle cry of the future would be equalitarianism. As a result, not because he necessarily liked that future, but he felt that it would be useless to be reactionary. It would be futile for him to say, I'm against it. There is no point in having any sympathy for it, any feeling for it. I'll dig in my heels and fight it every step of the way as a conservative. On the contrary, he felt, I must understand the direction of history, must be able to interpret what it means sympathetically, so that to some extent we can control, we can moderate, and we can impede any damage that democracy and equality might cause. Thus, de Tocqueville was a remarkably realistic man. He knew the nature of the future better than most men. And so it is not America as a republic he studies, but democracy in America. Now, it is interesting that the two great books of the last century published about the United States by foreigners were by de Tocqueville and by von Holst, H-O-L-S-T. Von Holst, as a German, came over here first as an immigrant. He landed in New York, and the first thing he ran into was Tammany Hall. So von Holst became very unfriendly to what was going on in the United States from the very beginning. Von Holst wrote a long work, multi-volume work, entitled A Constitutional History of the United States. Von Holst's study began with the formation of the Federal Union, the Constitution, and it continued through the Civil War and somewhat beyond. Now, what von Holst felt the direction of the future was, and here he was a rather unfriendly commentator. And this is why his book has not been reprinted. Von Holst and de Tocqueville were the two great works by foreigners on this country in the last century. De Tocqueville has been reprinted again and again, and von Holst has never been reprinted. But von Holst felt that the direction of this country was going to be towards centralization and totalitarianism. He felt that a highly centralized government had been created, and that the direction of that government would be, with each administration, more and more centralization. And to a great degree, he was right, because the Federalists were for a strong federal government. The Democratic Republican Party was against it. And when they clashed and got in their candidate, Jefferson, actually exercised more power as a president than either Washington or Adams, the Federalists, had done. So it was an ironic factor that the very party that got into power saying that we want to limit the power of Washington increased it. And of course, we have seen that in our day, have we not? Each administration has done that, and some years ago, one president gained power by campaigning very effectively on cutting the budget, on limiting the bureaucracy, on getting back to small government, and warning Americans what a dangerous road the centralization of power was. That was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who did more to centralize power in Washington than almost any other president. Von Holst was right. There was this danger, this steady movement towards increasing federal power, towards the centralization of power in Washington. So we see that, in a sense, these two foreigners, although having vastly different opinions of the United States, one emphasizing centralization and totalitarianism, and the other emphasizing democracy and equality, but very friendly and sympathetic, most appreciative of the United States, were in effect giving a rather remarkable perspective of the future of the United States. They were pointing ahead both to the 20th century, to the crisis which is upon us today, when we see very clearly that Washington's power is increasing to the point where we are now virtually in economic fascism. Fascism, economic fascism, is the control of the economy by the central government. We have that today. And if we get gas rationing and other things, we will have full-fledged economic fascism. We don't have political fascism yet. But remember, when there was talk of impeachment a while back, not that it's died down, but there was actually talk at the same time of a coalition government. In other words, political fascism. Let the two parties come together. They're both virtually espousing the same thing, and let us have, in effect, a political fascism. Thus, while we may disagree with some things de Tocqueville said, and some things that von Holst has to say, it is important for us, both tonight and again later this week and next week, to understand what de Tocqueville had to say, because it was so intensely important to the future of the country. Now, as we begin our analysis of de Tocqueville, one of the first things that de Tocqueville commented on was that there was a spirit of democracy in virtually all of the United States. De Tocqueville, in commenting on democracy in America, was not talking about the form of government. He knew about the Constitution, which we analyzed in some detail this morning, about checks and balances, about the three equal branches of government, about the powers reserved to the individuals and the state, the great pains taken in the Constitution to preserve a republic, even to the point of making it impossible for the country ever legally to be a full-fledged democracy. The one thing in the Constitution that is likely never really to be changed, short of some fantastic fact, is the fact that the states are always to get equal representation. Every state will always have, it is reasonable to assume, two senators. Because according to the Constitution, that cannot be changed unless every state gives its agreement to that. I cannot see Nevada, as I remarked this morning, agreeing to give up its two senators and going to one so that, say, California can have 10 on a proportionate basis. That's hardly likely that any small state in the Union will agree to surrender its two senators so that New York and California can have one of them. Thus, the Constitution forbids full, total legal democracy. De Tocqueville, therefore, bypasses this aspect. He discusses the form of government. He's fully appreciative of it. But what he is concerned with is this. There is a spirit of democracy in the country. What is this spirit of democracy going to lead to? Now, de Tocqueville was appreciative of this in part. He was aware of the fact that this spirit of democracy prevailed in the United States because there was no nobility here. In Europe, you were born into a situation where some people were lords and had power, not because they were any smarter than you, but because somebody way back centuries before had been smarter, had carved out an estate, become a lord, and passed it on generation after generation. Now, in a sense, there's a great deal of comfort and satisfaction living in an aristocracy, a hereditary aristocracy. One of the things it does do is to give everyone a good excuse. You see, there is no feeling of great resentment if you can say, I'm as good as he is. He just inherited it. But when you produce a meritocracy in which everybody earns what he gets and that's it, you have no excuse. You cannot say, I'm as good as Lord so-and-so. That old blighter is stupid. He hardly knows how to come in out of the rain. That can give you a sense of satisfaction. But if ever a strict meritocracy should be created in which you get what you deserve, then you have no excuse. And then you see resentment sets in. Envy, jealousy, hatred. And this, of course, de Tocqueville recognized. When you create a democratic situation, it has tremendous advantages. It enables the man who has ability to get ahead. And he recognized that there were great and powerful families in the United States, many of the southern states, as Virginia, for a long time the most populous state and the most important state. In Pennsylvania, in Massachusetts, and that these people could not be called an aristocracy in any old world sense. They knew they had earned it by work. And as a matter of fact, as de Tocqueville points out, and others pointed out 50 years after de Tocqueville, if any American got so rich that he wanted to quit working, he didn't stay in the United States. Because everybody would despise him. The idea of the idle rich was something that was just totally reprobate in the eyes of Americans. So, if you wanted to quit working and live off your wealth, you went over to England. You moved over to Europe. Because here, instead of being a gentleman, people would consider you a joke. Something to despise. Work was the life of man here. Rich and poor, work was what was respected. And therefore, there was no chance for an idle rich to survive here. Thus, there was no aristocracy in any traditional sense in the United States outside of New York, where you had some of the old Dutch patroons still holding large estates. But even those were breaking up and beginning to disappear by the time de Tocqueville had come. Then, second, de Tocqueville recognized that there was a major revolution that had taken place here, in that the old European ideas of inheritance had been dropped. This was an important factor. Now, there are two kinds of inheritances that have been the curse of some countries. In the one kind of inheritance, it is the unbroken estate. It means that, for example, an English lord or an English gentleman could not, by any means, even be so desired, break up his holding. It had to be passed unbroken to the eldest son. That was called primogeniture. Now his eldest son might be someone he despised totally, but he still could not pass over that eldest son to the second son. So traditionally, in countries that had this, such as England, what happened was that your eldest son got everything. He inherited the title if there was a title, or if you were a farmer and you had lands of any consequence, he inherited the land. And you took your second son and you bought a commission for him in the armed forces and made him an officer. Whether he was a competent officer or not made no difference. And that's why for a long time in Europe, until Napoleon came around and changed the whole military system, and even then the other countries were slow in picking up Napoleon's ideas of an army of officers based on merit, the officers were second sons, the third sons, for whom their father had bought a commission so that they could have a good income the rest of their life as an army officer, competent or incompetent. And some of them were exceedingly incompetent. Then what he did with another son was to send him to be a priest in earlier days or a Church of England rector later on, and to make sure that he got a good church and a good living. And, of course, it was commonplace in the Church of England for a long time to read a book of homilies. Or, if you wrote your own, to write a handful of them, which you preached on special occasions, and the rest of the time, you just went through the evening prayer and the morning prayer and the Book of Common Prayer. In fact, when I was a student, read the autobiography of one English clergyman whose father had been such a Church of England man, a younger son who had been into the church. And he had written 10 sermons which he felt covered all the basics of the Christian faith, and during a very long life as a Church of England director, 50 to 60 years active, He never used any other term. Every 2 or 3 months, when there was an occasion that required a sermon, Christmas and Easter and a few others, he would pull out one of these sermons and get up there and read them. That's all he did for 50 years. Now, you can see what this kind of situation did to a nation. It created some serious problems. This is why the French Revolution was inevitable. In France, you had so many of these younger sons who were a part of the lesser aristocracy and had certain privileges and felt they were above doing certain kinds of work because the sense of being an aristocrat was much more severe in France. That a tremendous body of people was created who were inept, incompetent, or unwilling because it would be a disgrace to them to do any kind of work except a certain kind of work. You had created a situation where there were so many limitations on people advancing or doing anything other than their own vocation or their own background, their own station in life required, that it was impossible for them to function. And so the revolution just wiped out all that impossible. But, on the other hand, you had another problem. Fractional heirship. Now, in fractional heirship, there had to be a division of land equally. I was reading a book on Switzerland a few years ago, in which the author of Swiss stated that in that part of Switzerland, which had been home to him, some of the farms were not being farmed any longer. Why? It was just too much work to locate all the heirs, because the property had been divided and redivided so that a 10-acre parcel of land might have 50 or 60 heirs today, and you would have to do a legal search for many of them who were in cities to get their signature on a piece of paper to lease 10 acres of land and use it. In fact, he cited one case where, in this family, the will, in dividing up this small farmhouse and farm, actually stated that one of the daughters had title to a seat, a cushioned seat next to the fireplace. That was her part of the fractional heirship. It would get that precise. Fractional heirship, again, is a serious problem. This is a problem I'm familiar with because one of the serious mistakes this government made when it set up the Indian reservation system in the early days was to set up fractional heirship for the Indians. That as they divided the land, each Indian was to get so much, and then his children were to inherit it equally. Well, some of the lands in the West where the reservations were by the 1940s and 50s, 70, 80 years old, a single piece of land might have 20, 40, 60, 80 heirs. And so, to lease that land, some white man who would try to lease the land would find they would have to hire a lawyer to hunt down all the Indians and get their signatures. And in some cases, it wasn't worthwhile. They couldn't find them. And until they could, they had no title to the land. No right to lease it. Now, what happened in America was that all of these European systems of inheritance were set aside. Just wiped out. The father had the right to talk out the eldest son if he didn't like him and thought he were ungodly. He had the right to leave it all to one son or to divide it up or to give it to his daughter. The father was given control over the property to divide it as he saw fit. This was a real revolution. But it also did something else. Very seriously, property now ceased to represent the family. Before, there was an equation, family and property. The family was the custodian of property. And now, the equation of family and property was broken. And this was revolutionary, because it meant that property was always changing hands now, and there was no longer the same permanence in a community. Now, in a few parts of the South, you will find, in a few parts of the West, here and there, where families have held on to property, and you can look at a piece of land and say, well, that's been Griswold land from way back. Well, that's been Johnson land, but there aren't many of those places. And this means that land changes very, very rapidly. And there isn't the same stability in the community. Now, this is a problem that we have not yet dealt with and solved properly as a society. The extreme answer, of course, is Tibet. In Tibet, polyandry is practiced. In other words, the property belongs to all the sons. And therefore, the sons marry one wife. Instead of polygamy, polyandry. So that there will not be a division. And it is the most retrograde type of economy and social arrangement the world knows. No progress is possible under this system in Tibet. And I think it's the providence of God that the communists have gone in there and are breaking it up. Because the gospel could make no toehold where a property was so idolized that marriage and a family were geared only to the preservation of property. Now, what this kind of thing did in America was that, and this is the third important point that de Tocqueville brings out, and I think you begin to see how sharp an observer de Tocqueville was, and how worthwhile his books are to read. It meant that instead of land being wealth as it has been throughout most of history, money became wealth. And this was, again, a great revolution. Because historically, wealth has been associated with having a piece of land or a house and handing that down to your children. Having something permanent. Something in the way of a possession that you can call your own and rejoice in all your life and think with delight that, well, my children are going to enjoy this, or my son is. But now, in America, it was no longer land. For one thing, so many farmers were selling their farms regularly and moving westward to buy cheaper land and make more money. So that money was now the important thing. Money was the test of wealth rather than land. And this again, as de Tocqueville saw, is a very, very dangerous thing, because it creates, yes, continual change, but also a sense of impermanence. It doesn't give people the same kind of rooting in the past. They don't have the same sense of permanence. Then, next, as de Tocqueville recognized his fourth point, power in the United States, political power, is in the hands of the people. At that time, it was emphatically true. The federal government was very, very weak, even though they considered it was getting too strong at that time. The federal government was a very weak government. It had a handful of officials. The state governments of that day were, again, very weak. As a matter of fact, up until just a few years ago, in Indiana, the state capital, they had the upper story and apartments for all the state officials. They could house them right there. They'd come in and take care of their business while the state government was in session and live up there in the Capitol building and then all go home. Now, of course, Indiana has umpteen State buildings in downtown Indianapolis. But that kind of small government was routine in one state after another across the country. It meant, therefore, that there was no strong government breathing down your neck all the time. And the people, effectively, could feel that they ran the country. The basic government was in their hands, and it was self-government. So, fifth, he makes the point, and I quote, society governs itself for itself. Then again, De Tocqueville says, and I quote, nothing is more striking to a European traveler in the United States than the absence of what we term government or the administration, unquote. Government was a very minor thing. You didn't see public buildings all over the landscape. They were few and far between. Government officials were few and far between. Today we have as many in California almost as you have in Washington, D.C., federal officials, I mean. And when you consider how many there are, say, in Chicago and Denver and New York and various other big cities across the country, you realize how many Washingtons we have in the United States. Now, the European was used to seeing government officials everywhere. And he distrusted them, and he was afraid of them. To him, the government was something to fear. I can recall when I was a very, very small boy. I had just barely started school. We had moved from California at that time to Detroit. And my father went to the railroad station to meet this priest who was coming to this country, an old friend of his, from France. Now, this priest had a European and Middle Eastern view of the police. They were something to be afraid of because they were so closely associated with the police state idea. And remember, this is the early 20s when what we would call a police state totalitarianism was very, very mild compared to what it is in Europe today. When my father and this priest were coming home, they saw at one corner a school crossing and a blue-coated policeman standing there helping the kids, holding hands across the walk. And all the kids, policeman was an older policeman, but that was his beat. In those days, you had policemen walking a beat, and he was always there at that time, and he loved the kids, and the kids loved him. And the old priest broke down and wept. And he said, now I know I am in America. Well, you see, we no longer feel quite that way. That is gone or disappearing. But especially in De Tocqueville's day, this was very striking. You could go all through the United States and you'd never see a state official or a federal official. You knew that somewhere there was such a government. But the most you ever saw was maybe the town mayor and the town constable, and nobody regarded him as anybody, and it was high throw, that sort of thing. And this was a very striking fact to travelers like De Tocqueville. Then De Tocqueville commented, and I quote, in America, those complaints against property in general, which are so frequent in Europe, are never heard. Because in America there are no paupers, and as everyone has property of his own to defend, everyone recognizes the principle upon which he holds it. Unquote. Now, of course, de Tocqueville was not quite accurate there when he said there were no paupers. There were. And we had our slums there, and somewhat later, not tonight, I'll deal with what de Tocqueville had to say about the slums. But the slums were made up of people who had just newly arrived, who had nothing in many cases, were living a hand-to-mouth existence in the slums of New York and Boston and Philadelphia and Baltimore, trying to earn enough to move out, say, westward or out to the country or to some other town after they had earned enough money to buy something on their own. But basically, everyone was a property owner. Now, for some years at the beginning of the Republic and prior to the Constitution, there were property restrictions on voting. You had to own landed property or a house in order to be able to vote. This was never a federal qualification, but this was a state and county qualification. You see, there were three kinds of citizenship. You were a federal citizen, a state citizen, and you were a county citizen. And each of them had different qualifications for voting. It was easiest to vote in a federal election, whereas state and county elections had various property qualifications for a long time. Those property qualifications gradually were dropped, largely because they were meaningless. After all, everybody had property. Why bother to pass such laws? Everybody, or to keep them? Everybody owns land. Everybody owns his own house. This is practically universal. So, in essence, de Tocqueville was right. There was a strong property base in America. The people of this country, by and large, were very strongly secure in their homes and in their farms. They were living in terms of standards whereby they could, in effect, thumb their nose at the rest of the world, and they did. And this was one thing that many travelers resented. As a matter of fact, the most hated traveler of all in America was Mrs. Trollope. And Mrs. Trollope and her husband came here a little later than to Tocqueville and went to Cincinnati. He tried to make some money, and he lost. In fact, he got wiped out. They went back there, and she wrote a very irritable book about the people of America. I believe the title is something like Manners and Customs in the United States. And if she'd ever come back, I think they would have lynched her in every town of America, because she portrayed the Americans as people who had nothing but barbaric manners, no respect for English gentlemen and ladies, and as yahoos who in effect thumbed their nose at all good breeding and good standards as any civilized European would. She was very offended with just about everything she ever saw in America. And her book just reeks of disgust with America from one end to the other. She was at some point a good observer, but she was looking down her nose at America all the time. Well, in a sense, she was right in this respect. The Americans all felt they were just as good as anybody else, and especially on in the western, newly settled states, which we would today call Middle Western. Their manners and ways were sometimes shocking to Europeans. When a titled lord would show up, instead of bowing to him, they'd say, "Put her there, Duke." Mm-hmm. And especially in that area, one of the things that horrified the Europeans was the habit of chewing tobacco and the habit of spitting incessantly. And some of the European travelers said it was very dangerous to be on the wrong side of the wind where any Western American was concerned. Well, that sort of thing upset a good many Europeans. All this, of course, leads to another point that de Tocqueville made, and one with which we, in effect, began. Equality. This ethos is basic. This is the direction of things. Life in the United States is creating a marvelous way of life for people. But it is leading to an insistence on equality. Everybody feels he's as good as everyone else. And he feared it could lead to totalitarianism. He recognized that so far there was no sign of it in the United States. But, he said, when you have equalitarianism, it dissolves all lesser authority, and it leaves only the state. Because when you have a society which, in which to some degree there is authority and a measure of position, prestige, some kind of aristocracy, you do have the state up here. But you have the church and bishops, priests, pastors, all whom have authority and people look up to them. And you have the nobility. And people look up to them, and they exercise authority locally. And you have businesses and firms. They have a tremendous authority, and the boss is somebody that you say sir to, and you bow and pray to him, and so on, as they still do in England and many countries of Europe. And he said, as you go through one area of life, including the family, in the family, the authority of the father and of the grandfather and the grandmother of the mother is far greater in countries that have a tradition of aristocracy. Because obedience to authority is more or less a way of life. But what happens? In a democracy, he said, the authority of the church disappears. The authority of nobles is non-existent. The boss is somebody, if you don't like, you can tell him off and walk off and get another job. And if you don't like your family, you can run off, as a lot of Americans were doing at 9, 10, 11 years of age and getting a job elsewhere. Nothing else you could go to see as a cabin boy. That was very common at 9 and 10. Admiral Farragut, at 59, was a 50-year veteran of the U.S. Navy. So, de Tocqueville said, you have the individual and you have the state. Whereas in an aristocracy, while there are many things that may not be quite as beneficial, you have a variety of institutions that claim authority and will not share it. They will not surrender it to the state if they can help it. They are insistent that their authority be maintained. And so the power of the state is diluted. But when you wipe out all these authorities, he said, ultimately the state as the only authority gets more and more powerful, and you have totalitarianism. Now there's a great deal to what de Tocqueville said. Extremely telling analysis. The question, of course, that we need to think about is this. Can, through Christian faith, a kind of authority be created so that you don't have to have the old paraphernalia of a